My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. This week at the show, I welcome Jamili Cannon, co-founder of Workbench, a vertically integrated housing developer based in Santa Cruz, California. Jamili is an architect developer, leading projects that tackle one of the biggest challenges facing our profession today, how to design and deliver housing that communities actually need and that can actually and realistically get built. Through her work leading multidisciplinary teams, navigating complex regulations and building systems for scalable design, build, delivery, Jamili offers a practical perspective on what it takes to move projects from vision to reality in today's evolving housing market. Jamili Cannon, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here, Mark. Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you here. You've been a part of the community for a very long time.
I have.
Thank you for that. You're a member at Entree Architect Network. You're a member of one of the mastermind groups, and you've been to TCAM, the conference that we do. And so it's great to have you on the show. I can't wait to share your story and what you do.
Thank you.
I want to learn about you. When did you discover your passion for architecture, and who or what inspired you to get started?
Yeah, so I grew up in a really small town in Northern California, and we had some family in San Francisco and then also some family out in Pittsburgh. And I just remember being so fascinated as a kid going to these big cities from this little rural town, you know, these places where strip malls didn't exist. And there was just this incredible fabric of old and new buildings. And it was just so full of visual interest in life. And I think that was a very formative early memories in my childhood. And then in high school, I was drawn, you know, your guidance counselor says, pick a college, pick a career. And
right.
I'm like, well, I like math and I like practical, logical things. And I also like art. So maybe I'll be an architect. You know, about as much thought as a 17-year-old puts into what they're going to do.
That is the thought process of many, many architects.
Yes, exactly. So I was luckily accepted at Cal Poly and I spent a year abroad in Florence. And that was just so influential in seeing how European cities were built, and even the smallest little town still had a vibrant city center. Might be three stores, but it was a square. It was a place where community gathered. And I think that really gave me a sense of like, well, we're kind of missing out here on the West Coast. Like, what can we do a little differently that emulates that and helps people live in that kind of a community and in that kind of a space? So after school, I worked for architecture firms for a little while. And it turns out I didn't really love being an architect, at least not an entry-level architect. And so I made my way over to working for a construction management firm. I did school bond renovation work, which was really fulfilling and satisfying. And also, you know, you did three quarters of the work in the summer while there were no kids there. And then I spent the rest of the year dealing with teachers and parents and students and trying to do construction. So I learned a ton. It was really interesting. And then eventually I went to work for a large multifamily general contractor, and I was a project manager there for about 6 years, built two really big housing projects for them. And then actually almost exactly 10 years ago, my then boyfriend, now husband and business partner, Tim, and I decided to leave San Francisco and we moved to Santa Cruz. We started a design build company, and with a financial partner, we bought our first development, which at the time we thought was going to be about 5 or 6 units. And then turns out with some state laws that started to come into play around the time that we purchased it, it was actually a 15-unit townhouse development. So we started our company. We worked on figuring out how to buy that project. And we also started with ADUs. At the time, the state had really focused on changing ADU law in California in order to facilitate more housing production. And that was like a much smaller, easier way for us to get into the market in Santa Cruz. And then about 6 years ago, we brought in a third partner who'd been doing similar work but with a more impact focus. So he had a development company and then an impact investment fund. And that partnership really reshaped what we could do at scale, both because we had another person to help us run it and manage it, but then also because he had a little different funding stream coming in and had already started a couple bigger projects. And then, you know, fast forward to today, we now run pre-approved ADU programs in jurisdictions all over California. So rather than doing one-offs, we've transitioned to doing these larger scale projects for jurisdictions. And then we develop larger multifamily projects anywhere from 50 to about 350 units, both for our clients and for ourselves. And to date, we have about 150 units built, another 200 almost complete, and about 1,700 in the pipeline.
All right. Well, you've come a long way.
We've been busy in the last decade.
On that first project, was that a building that had already existed, or was that a building that was approved and you were going to build it?
It was an existing parcel. There's a lot of this kind of property in Santa Cruz County where we are, but I think also just in general and, you know, coastal and generally in California, this kind of infill density parcel. So it was zoned RM. We could build more than single family homes on it, but it had two single family homes on it. It had been in the family forever. The parents had passed and the kids who were the trustees wanted to sell the property. So we bought it. And at the time, I think it was 5 or 6 units that we could do, maybe 7. We had talked to the local council member and they're like, well, we won't support anything over 2 stories. So, you know, basically didn't say it, but if you build 3 stories, we're not going to support your project. And right around that same time too, the first density bonus law in California was coming out. And so we waited, we actually stalled on the project, I don't know, 6 months or a year, I think, in order to take advantage of that density bonus. And we ended up with 15 units rather than 5 or 6 units.
Was it hard to delay the project in terms of funding? How was that project funded, that first one?
Yes. Okay. So that's a good question. We basically asked for every single extension we could get on the project. We met with everybody we could possibly think of and get introductions to in Santa Cruz who was doing this kind of work. And a week before the last extension was going to run out, the first contingency, we had to release our first contingency. We found a partner who said, yeah, we'll do that project with you. They have done other multifamily stuff. They're from Santa Cruz, but hadn't done a lot of stuff in Santa Cruz. And they really wanted to put their money locally where they live. And they've been a great partner to us. So we managed to secure them. We released that contingency. And then we, you know, stretched out as much as we could on the next contingency release. And we got the bank loan to close on the property like the day before we had to buy it or lose it. And the whole thing took maybe 4 months from start to finish, I think, to close on it. But we had been looking for a year or so at the time. You know, at the time that we went into contract on that, we've been looking for over a year for something like that, some kind of infill property that we could develop.
And that was your first project? That's how you launched Workbench?
Yep. And like I said, in combination with the ADUs, we actually ended up with an ADU client who said, oh, well, I have these 9 homes that I'm building that you guys might actually be able to do the CDs and be the builder on for me. And so kind of in tandem, we were doing the ADUs, we had purchased the property, the 15 units, and then we also ended up with a really great client who was doing 9 homes for developmentally disabled adults, you know, kind of a really unique funding structure. And those things all came together at the same time. Essentially, probably like around 2018, 2019.
Yeah. How are you marketing yourself when you first launched? How did people even know that you existed and that you were doing that type of work?
Great question. This is a fun trip down memory lane here. We ran a couple of different versions of ads or sponsorships on NPR. You know, we knew that our clientele was going to be, if we're specifically for the ADUs, our clientele would be probably a little older, have some money, wanting to do this work on their homes, and probably listening to the local NPR station. So we ran those campaigns, and then Tim and I spent every spare second we had going to planning commission meetings, attending YIMBY meetings, being involved in the chamber, basically meeting everybody we could possibly meet in the community that was either politically connected or really more focused on who else is developing housing. What are they doing? Can we be supportive of them so they're supportive of us?
Can you describe Santa Cruz so we understand the type of town that you're focused on?
Yeah. So we're about 30 minutes from San Jose and 45 minutes or so from Palo Alto and heart of Silicon Valley. Since the .com, there's been a large influx of people who work what's called over the hill. There's a pretty windy, gnarly road called 17 that goes over the Santa Cruz Mountains to the Bay. to San Jose and Silicon Valley. And so since the early 2000s, there's been a large influx of people moving here, Silicon Valley kind of wealth, computer and tech money. But up until then, Santa Cruz had been just a sleepy little surf town on the coast of California.
Got it.
The actual city is only 60,000 people. The countywide, we're about 250, but we're really land constrained. So we have the Pacific Ocean on one side, we have Redwood Mountains on the other. And then if you go north towards San Francisco, there's protected ag land, and same with south. So we're really constrained, which is why the infill housing is, that's the solution for where we live.
Right. So it's taking all the lots that haven't yet been built, subdividing those properties off and building on them.
Yep.
And lots of tear down and rebuild as well?
Yes. It's a funny market because the property we bought, there were two existing homes. We kept them both because the cost of construction is so high. It didn't make sense to tear them down. We actually relocated one and kept the other one, just did a little bit of a renovation on it. Now on our larger projects that are really in the commercial corridors or in the downtown, those projects are all tear down. So those are replacing old commercial buildings, or, you know, we have a couple of client projects where there's non-conforming existing uses of, you know, three single family, one story, 800 square foot homes right on the main corridor that's now zoned multifamily or commercial. So a lot of the bigger stuff we're doing now is tear down.
Yeah. And so it's basically a calculation, right? How much is it going to cost to tear that down and rebuild something else versus renovating what that is and not being able to build what would replace it?
Exactly.
And what ends up becoming a more valuable investment.
Yeah.
Because I can imagine in other parts of the country, much of those buildings would be tear downs because they would just, the calculation would work out. But in Northern California, property values are some of the highest property values in the country.
Yep.
And so.
And the cost of construction since COVID has just been through the roof. So
yeah,
it's not a great combination.
Yeah. So you also talked about doing ADUs, accessory dwelling units, for anybody who doesn't know what an ADU is. There are small accessory buildings that typically are a part of a property that has a main building on it that are used for living. So small houses, basically. Mm-hmm. How does that work with the other types of work that you do? Is it compatible, or is it just two separate building types that you focus on?
And the building typologies are different, but I think of them all as very compatible in the sense of they're all adding to the housing stock in California and they're all infill. So the ADUs are the kinds of infill that you can do in a single family zoned neighborhood, or that like a mom and pop could do. And that would really create multi-generational living for them or additional income for them. And then the larger projects are infill that we're doing on a bigger scale.
Got it. So infill is your niche.
Yes.
And your brand. That's what you're known for. That's what you've built your story around is we take all those little difficult to develop properties, and because we're creative and smart and good at what we do, we can come up with ways to design and develop livable buildings on them.
Exactly.
Very interesting. Sounds fun.
It's been great. It's been a wild ride.
Yeah.
But yeah, going back to that, you know, origin of really discovering cities and loving them. And the vibrant part about them is that they are dense and there is a lot happening in a small area. And there's resources for people, you know, so there's the coffee shop and the laundromat and the grocery store.
Yeah.
All that you can walk to.
Yeah. It sounds like a nice place to be. I should go visit someday.
It's a beautiful place.
Let's take a quick break to say thank you to our sponsors for their support of this episode. This episode of Entree Architect Podcast is supported by WeCollabify, one of our trusted allied partners. As this community has grown over the years, one thing has become very clear to me. The partners we choose matter. Allied partners are not sponsors. They're not advertisers. They are organizations that we've taken the time to get to know, to work alongside, and to trust. They understand the real pressures of practice and the responsibility that comes with leading a small firm. WeCollabify earned that trust by helping small firm owners address a challenge that sits at the center of long-term firm health. building capacity in a way that supports people, not just projects. Their insourcing model brings skilled design, BIM, and technical professionals directly into your team. They work in your time zone, inside your systems, and part of your day-to-day workflow. That integration allows firms to add capacity when it's needed, scale with intention, and grow without sacrificing culture, leadership focus, or quality of life. If you're thinking beyond short-term fixes and focused on building a firm that lasts, I encourage you, go learn why WeCollabify is one of our trusted allied partners. Visit WeCollabify.com/EntreeArchitect to learn more. That's WeCollabify.com/EntreeArchitect. Gain lessons learned and credits earned with Arcademy, Arcat's continuing education program. Listen to popular episodes of the Detailed podcast and earn AIA-approved HSW credits. Yes, you heard that right, HSW credits for episodes of Detailed podcast. Listen to an episode, check out the learning objectives, and use what you've learned while listening to take the course. The program is free, it's simple, and can be found at arcat.com under the Resources tab, or just go to arcat.com/arcademy. That's arcat.com/arcademy. That's arcat.com/arcademy. Please visit our sponsors today and thank them. Thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. As an architect focusing on development, you said early on that you went to school for architecture, you came out into architecture, and it wasn't really for you. Today, you're doing architect as developer. So you're an architect, but you're a developer. Are you still doing architecture in that, or is somebody else in the firm doing architecture? What's your role in the firm?
Yeah, my role tends to be our operations. So I tend to be doing more of how are we running the company and who's doing what on any given day in terms of the staffing. Lately, in the last year, I've transitioned to focusing more on our fundraising efforts. So all of these projects take a lot of capital to get done. And we're, as a company, realizing like, we need to be very focused on how we're funding our work. And so Tim, myself, and our partner Sibley are all three making more of a full court press on the capital. And we have a great lead architect who's really an excellent designer. And I have a small team, but they've all grown up with us learning these state laws and learning how to do this kind of housing. And they're all incredibly savvy at it. So they're led by Omar, who's my lead architect. I check in with him on a regular basis once a week or more. So I'm seeing everything that we're producing and they're asking me questions about it, but I'm not drafting it in Revit. You know, I'm giving big picture ideas and feedback on it. And they're really doing the bulk of the work.
Can you talk a little bit about the firm and how it's structured? How many people work with you? How do you work? Do you work remotely? Or are you in an office?
Yeah, so we're 15 people right now. We kind of fluctuate between 15 and maybe 25 or so. I think a lot of small firms as they're growing have this issue. Actually, I was talking about this with my Entree Architect, with my mastermind group a couple of weeks ago. I was like, you always feel, it doesn't matter what size you are, you always feel like you need to be a little smaller or a little bigger. So we always feel like that. But right now we're about 15 people. We are 5 or 6 people on the architecture team. We are 4 people on the development team. We have an office manager who we could not live without. And then we have 3 people on our accounting team because they're running, 28 sets of books at this point in time because of all the properties. And we have 3 people on our construction team. So right now we're pretty small and nimble and we have a lot of, like I said, we have a lot of work in the pipeline. So as those projects get closer to being ready for construction, I could see us needing to ramp up our construction team. The development team, we always need more people there, but it's really hard to fund it because that particular business gets money every once in a while when a project refinances or has some major milestone. So we're basically running 3 companies. We're running a construction company, a design company, and a development company. And I have not figured out how to, they just don't operate the same. I have not figured out how to make that easier to manage yet.
Yeah.
Maybe in the next decade, I can figure that out.
When you do, you come back and you can share that story.
Yeah, absolutely. And then we work in the office 2 days a week. So Tuesdays and Thursdays, we're in the office. And then everyone can decide what they do with their Monday, Wednesday, Fridays. So, you know, I'm usually in about 4 days a week. Some people are in two, some people are in five. But we always know we have Tuesday, Thursday together.
Yeah. So it sounds like a merit-based firm where as long as you get your work done, we're good with how you do it.
Yeah. And we really felt like, you know, we had young kids during COVID and we just realized, like, honestly, to everybody who raised their kids before COVID, I don't know how you did it. I don't know how you did a 40-plus hour work week and picked up your kids and did anything else while running your firm. So I think this has really allowed all of us just a sanity check to, you know, I can be home and if I need to leave at 1 to go get my kids, I can do that. It's not a big deal and I can come back and work. And I think that means a lot to people here too.
Yeah. I think flexible hours is a critical piece of firm culture, especially today, that you have professionals that have families and you want to be able to be flexible so they can do what they need to do as parents, but also be available when you need them at work. And if you build a culture that's intentional around that, it works.
Yeah, it's taken a while, but you know, I think we have a great team right now too. And we don't feel like anyone's taking advantage of that. Everyone's working hard and living here in this beautiful place that we live, which is, we all also want to go be outside and be involved in our kids' lives. And this allows everybody to do a bit of both.
How is Workbench different from other developers, being an architect-led developer?
Yeah, I feel like we're more nimble. So you don't have to call another company when you want to do a base density study or a quick site diagram or something like that. Like Tim will say, hey, does anybody on the design team have time to do this right now? And I'll say, yes, Omar or Dan or so-and-so can get this in the next week. And because the team has done so many of these types of projects, they're really savvy at them and can get them right the first time around and get that work done pretty quickly. So I'd say the benefits are that we can be a lot more nimble. And I think the downside is that leadership is making all of the decisions on all of the projects, which is a lot of decision fatigue.
Yeah, right, exactly. Because you have all three pieces of the development puzzle. That's all your responsibility. So
yeah,
and you have nobody that can pick up the slack, but you also have nobody you can blame, right?
Exactly.
But you also have total control over the projects that you do. So they become more efficient, potentially more profitable, and it works really well. So being an architect developer, you have a very unique position, but also being in California, my understanding, I'm in the East Coast, but my understanding is that California regulations are really difficult and pretty restrictive. And being a developer and an architect and a builder, is there an advantage because you have all those pieces in-house in terms of California and understanding the rules and the regulations and the efficiency that comes with all of those pieces in one place?
Yeah, for sure. Having the development and architecture team in-house as it relates to California and policy specifically, I think there's a lot of benefit. And then I think where having the construction team in-house comes into play is as the developer, we have easier access to how much is stuff going to cost, what decisions do we need to make. Oh, we learned this lesson on the last project. Let's not install that kind of siding or this material or whatever the thing is. Which you learn from a GC, we just have, unfortunately, more intimate knowledge of it because we're also bearing the brunt of the costs of those decisions. So we won't make them again. And yeah, but in terms of being all in one, I think having that state law knowledge and then being able to just easily communicate it between the teams is a huge advantage.
Yeah. And California is also a leader in ADUs. And you don't just design ADUs. I think I heard you say that you're developing ADU. Can you explain what you do with jurisdictions?
Yeah. So the prototype programs, there was some state funding maybe 5 years ago, I want to say, for jurisdictions to pre-approve like a package of ADUs. So a jurisdiction would put out an RFP for, we want 4 different size ADUs with 3 different exterior styles on them. And then if you're a member of that community, you would have access to those plans already pre-approved, and all you need to, all, it's not like right. It's still
hard, right. Yeah.
But all you need to do as a homeowner is do your site plan. And then ideally, if you're in somewhere where like the soil conditions are normal and you're not on a slope and you're not near a riparian corridor and all those things, you can really just go down to the building department, submit your site plan with our set of already pre-approved drawings and expedite that and not pay for an architect or a structural engineer or all the other people that are needed to build the building. So I think at this point, I think we've done 8 of those projects for different jurisdictions throughout California. We're working on one with South Lake Tahoe right now that should be done in the next month. And the goal there is for jurisdictions to really streamline and make this process less expensive and fewer hurdles for people in their jurisdiction. And then on our side, we feel like this is great because we're not doing a one-off drawing here. We're doing something that lots of people will ultimately get to use.
How do you get paid for that? Is the jurisdiction the client? Mm-hmm. Is it just a flat fee for a certain number of designs and then they own them and they have full license for them?
We do joint ownership. So I always mark up their contract to have joint ownership on them because we've found that we often end up using an iteration or potentially even the same unit in other jurisdictions.
Oh, so you can use it too in addition to them using it. So you have access to the design as well.
Yep.
But once they own it, they can do whatever they want with it.
Yep, they can do whatever they want with it. There's usually a disclaimer. You know, there's some legal language on the cover sheet, and then there's some legal language when somebody downloads it and removes the watermark so that, you know, our attorney drafted up some language that would protect us if people are making changes on the drawings.
But there's no licensing fee where when someone uses it, you're getting paid.
Yep.
They hire you, you do the work, you deliver the work, they send you a check, you're done.
Yep, exactly. And then there are a few jurisdictions like the city of Los Angeles and city of San Jose. They did their program differently where they used the money to do plan check on whichever firms wanted to submit their drawings. So you still have to go in those jurisdictions. You would go to city of San Jose's website. You would say, I like the ADU by this company. You would call that company and they would all have varying degrees of essentially a licensing fee or how you would work with them. And they would help you submit it. But that project's already been permitted or streamlined in San Jose. So you still get a faster project at a lower cost, but it's a little bit different process. So kind of depending on where you are in California, it works a little differently.
Yeah, that's a pretty innovative solution, especially for jurisdiction, you know, because jurisdictions are not exactly cutting edge. But I've heard of those projects before. Other architects in the community are doing those in California as well. And it's a very interesting concept. And I love the idea of, you know, having the opportunity to design buildings like that and having them pre-approved and then homeowners being able to very quickly, especially in California, where I hear approvals take many, many months, sometimes years to get approved, mm-hmm. having to be able to have a potential site for an ADU and just pick one and pay for it and have it pre-approved and go build it.
Yeah, it's such a huge undertaking for somebody who's not in this industry to decide they're going to build an ADU, figure out what all that means, get an architect, and then actually build it. It's already going to be hard, even if the plans are done. So removing any of those barriers and hurdles for people is a big win.
So what are your plans for Workbench in the future? What do you want Workbench to look like in the next 3-5 years?
If you ask any one of my partners, we'll all give you a different answer on a different day. In 3 to 5 years, I want to see the projects that we have entitled now built. So I think, you know, they're going to take the next 3 years to get funded and completed. And if in 3 years I drive around Santa Cruz and there's 600 units that I've built and started, I'm going to be really excited about that. And then our plan has always been if we can sign up 1 or 2 new projects a year, really it only takes 1 big project a year, that will fill our pipeline and really keep us busy. So to date, we've done a mix of for fee work for clients and our own work. And if we can sustain that in some ratio, doesn't really matter what the ratio is, I don't think. You know, we're going to build a lot of housing in our community. And that's what's really needed at the end of the day is like, okay, this is my skill set. I know how to do this. This is my way to be a positive, make a positive impact and have a positive contribution on the place that I live.
Yeah, that's awesome. Final question. What's one thing that a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
Specifically as it relates to the work that we do.
Yeah.
The local zoning, when a client comes to you with a potential multifamily site or an infill project, the local zoning, you can just throw it out the window. So really the thing that you can do is understand the state law and understand how those laws supersede the local zoning, and that you can probably do a lot more, build a lot more housing on that parcel than you would be able to under local zoning, and then that what you would even logically think that you could do. And so I think my advice or thought for people who are doing similar work to what we're doing is to really start to understand the state law, and even just to recognize that the local zoning isn't what matters anymore in California.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Very interesting. Her name is Jamili Cannon. Firm is Workbench. Workbenchbuilt.com is the website. Go check it out. You also have a podcast. You want to talk a little bit about the podcast, Jamili?
Sure. Yeah. We launched the podcast back in the fall to help other developers, architects, people in this community learn, take really deep dives into state law. So each episode breaks down one new, I'll say new, you know, new housing law within the last 5 to 10 years in the state of California, and tells people how to use it and how to implement it.
So the Infill Insiders is the name of the podcast. You can find it on the website. Just go to workbenchbuilt.com. It's right up on the top. Just click the link and you will find it there. Jamili, thank you very much for all the work that you're doing in California and helping a lot of people find homes, because you're building a whole bunch of homes. And thanks for being here and sharing your story at Entree Architect Podcast.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Mark. And thanks for all that you do for our community.
Well, you're very welcome. If you enjoyed this episode of Entree Architect Podcast, please share a link with a friend, because that's how we've continued to grow and serve thousands more small firm architects just like you. Thank you to our sponsors for this episode. Links to the sponsors and all the resources we discussed today, they are all available in the show notes for this episode at entrearchitect.com/podcast. Entree Architect is a proud member of the Gable Media Network. It's the multimedia network moving the architecture, engineering, and construction industries forward through the power of storytelling. You can earn AIA continuing education credits by listening to select episodes of this podcast and many others at gablemedia.com/members. And if you are a small firm architect, listen up. Join us today at Entree Architect Network. It's the worldwide community for entrepreneur architects. We've been around since 2012. And our basic level is now free to join. Yes, you can join Entree Architect Network for free. And that gives you access to valuable business resources and our global community of architects. And you can upgrade anytime for live coaching, AIA approved training, and mastermind support. So visit entrearchitect.com to learn more and to get started. My name is Mark R. LePage. Thank you for listening to the Entree Architect Podcast. Love, learn, share.